Hello, everyone in Construction Land. Welcome to another episode of Constructive Conversations, your source for anything and everything construction related. Today, I have two guests from Brown Edwards, two directors. We'll call them the Construction Tax Tag Team Champions of the World, Carla Brown and Corbin Rice. Carla and Corbin, it's great to have you all on the show today.
Thanks for having us.
Today, we're going to tackle something that's really relevant, been in the news a lot lately. Everybody's getting flyers and emails on this. And we're going to talk about the One Big Beautiful Bill, and also we'll touch on tariffs. So the One Big Beautiful Bill is a lot of words in the title itself. It's a lot of words in all of the tax code and laws. The bill itself is enormous. It's huge. It's big. It's beautiful. A lot of superlatives included in the title of it. But you two today are going to break it down and help us in the construction industry better understand how it's going to affect those that are working in construction and being affected by it. So first, let's have a little background. Carla, could you tell the audience a little bit about yourself?
I am a tax director in our Roanoke office, and I have been in public accounting for January. Coming up will be my 20th tax season. So I've done a little bit of work in Virginia Beach as well as Roanoke, but my focus has primarily been construction-related tax work and a little assurance services in there, too.
And Carla is a repeat guest on the podcast. Yeah. Corbin, would you like to tell everyone a little bit about yourself?
I'm Corbin Rice. I'm based out of the Lynchburg office. My focus is on construction. I do some work with Virginia Enterprise Zones and historic tax credits, as well as nonprofits. But my focus is construction, and I've been in the industry for over 25 years.
Well, it is terrific to have you both on the podcast today. We get to work a lot together, do a lot of training, and talk a lot about A&A and tax together. So we're going to dive into this, and hopefully we'll give our listeners a better understanding of this bill once we're finished. So let's start broad. How would you describe the overall impact of the One Big Beautiful Bill on the construction industry so far?
Say in the near term, I don't know that the construction industry is going to be severely impacted, because often the construction industry tends to lag a little behind certain trends due to the fact they usually have some backlog, you know, coming into the year. They have projects that are going to be going out 8, 12, 18 months. So sometimes it doesn't like greatly impact them immediately. They see it later on as they start to like bid and get new work. But I do think that there's going to be some near-term tax saving opportunities, because they have extended some depreciation options. They've added in some information for expensing R&D credits, as well as like the estate and gift tax exemption being made permanent. I think those can help probably within, you know, the next 12 months more than anything.
From my standpoint, I think the bill does allocate substantial federal funding for infrastructure projects, which will lead to a boost in the construction industry. I think areas like transportation, utilities, public facilities may see a little spike in the next 12 months. And in theory, you should see a positive impact across the industry, whether it be through increased construction jobs or some of the related fields like engineering, design, or project management. And I think while it's important to be poised to capitalize on the increased funding that may become available, I think it's also very important to just be strategically planning for regulatory changes that may impact your projects, contracts, considering the strain that may be placed on the supply chain, whether it be labor or materials, because with any increased activity, you know, there's going to be more demand for the resources that are available to you.
Definitely a lot of opportunities with this. What specific provisions in the bill had the most immediate effect on general contractors and subcontractors?
The prevailing wage rules, Buy American clauses, and the green building incentives will definitely impact how jobs are priced, how they're bid, delivered, especially on anything involving public works. I think you'll see some changes in the residential contract deferrals.
Yes, that's something that was expanded from percentage of completion method. Typically, in the past, if you develop or build like multi-unit residential projects, there has been a circumstance because historically, only home construction contracts involving buildings with four or fewer dwelling units could use completed contract method to defer their revenue. And the larger residential projects were forced to recognize income, you know, as the job progresses over the course of time. So with this, it's changed now to involve more than four units, including high-rise condos, senior living facilities, multifamily housing. You can now qualify for the deferral uncompleted contract method, which is going to allow contractors to defer income recognition until the contract is actually completed. So I think that's a good option that they have there. As Corbin mentioned, the green building initiatives, the Section 179D energy efficient commercial building deduction, that's going to terminate for projects that begin after June 30th, 2026. So something to be aware of now, those architects, engineers, the design build firms, they probably want to act as quickly as possible to look and see about claiming those deductions for their government and nonprofit projects before time runs out. And along those lines, the energy efficient home credit is also going to be expiring at the same date. So for home builders that are pursuing that credit, they want to make sure they coordinate all their documentation as soon as like the project starts to make sure nothing lags and they get that credit available to them before it's gone. Other things to think about is depreciation expense. Section 179 has been increased to $2.5 million this year. And the phase out starts at $4 million. So you can purchase a lot more and go ahead and write that off directly. And that begins with property this year. The 100% bonus depreciation is now going to be a permanent deduction going forward. So that helps. It started with property placed in service January 19th of 25. But while it gets you a tax deduction right now, just something to think about as far as how does it impact your cash flow, because a lot of that spending requires a large outflow of cash out up front, and that could be a circumstance depending upon what you have coming down the pike for work. Also, how does it affect your balance sheet as far as your debt ratios and like your bonding capacity? Just things to keep in the back of your mind.
Two, with a lot of incentives or accelerated deductions, you may run into a basis issue from a tax standpoint. So if you create a loss and you don't have the basis to take that loss, you may not have the desired impact. And so that's something that you need to balance over the course of time. I think the framework in this bill, too, is designed to allow easier access to low interest loans, grants to businesses. They're fast tracking the permitting process, and it has some provisions to increase bonding capacity for small businesses. But from the tax advisor's lens, I'm just encouraging clients to be aware of expiring provisions, to capitalize on those incentives that we've mentioned. Those things are time sensitive. And for companies that are eligible for what we call the R&D, the research and experimental expenditures, if you've been hesitant to do the studies in the past, now may be a time to revisit that. You can do 3 years at a time if it's still open in the statute. And then if you've been taking it and had to amortize the cost, we do have the option to go back and make decisions whether we want to amend returns or if we want to take the deduction in the current year. So that's an important point for tax planning and a reason to reach out to your advisor.
And we've seen some big credits come out of R&D in the past, so that's definitely a benefit that's going away. A lot of, you know, I guess part of this bill, the overall bill, is to eliminate some of the green credits, and that's probably why Elon and Trump are doing this, because
now the R&D credits are available. You know, they're not sunsetting, so that was a positive impact for businesses for which that applies.
So how have construction timelines and scheduling been affected by the bill?
I think the idea of the bill is to streamline more and potentially consolidate funding resources. But I do believe that the initial rollout of these changes probably going to have a little bit of a learning curve. And so sometimes that can cause time delays as everyone starts to implement new processes. I mean, where do you go for your permits? Things like that. So in the beginning, it might hold up some projects starting, but hopefully, and I think the goal is, in the long run, it's going to be better for that purpose.
There's, I guess part of the spirit of the bill is to spur growth, which, you know, in a time when there were already material shortages and labor shortages, and now you throw tariffs into that, it's going to make performing a job and getting it complete a lot more difficult, especially if everyone is taking advantage of this bill and having their contracts hitting the ground running and more jobs out there to do. So I could see that being a big impact on the construction industry just itself. Mm-hmm. So how has the bill changed how public and private construction projects are being funded or awarded?
For the public jobs, I would say yes, they're heavily influenced by the bill's funding. There's going to be competitive and compliance-heavy bid processes. Private developers, I think, are going to be more impacted by the tax credits and sustainability incentives.
How are small and minority-owned construction businesses navigating the changes under the new bill?
You know, under the new administration, I think there's a lot of uncertainty about the set-asides for small and women and minority-owned businesses. For now, those seem to still be intact. If you go to the SBA websites, there's still a fair amount of information regarding the certification process. There's still set-asides. If you look into the SAM search for different codes. So for now, that's still available. With that being said, I think bonding, legal guidance, and administrative capacity are certainly going to present a hurdle for smaller businesses simply because there's a reporting requirement there. Mentorship and partnership with the larger firms will kind of help bridge the gap. One thing that's permanent and for every pass-through entity, you know, the deduction for QPI was set to expire in 2025, but this provision has been made permanent. So outside of the bill with the SBA, there is a recertification change that is due to be implemented in 2026. If you are going through a merger and you're a small business and then you fund those contracts under those parameters, you may want to reach out and make sure that that merger will not impact your existing contracts. And if you are concerned about that 2026 date, if you do your merger that's completed before that date, the recertification will not impact you. So that's certainly a planning tip if you're in that space.
Deal. So from your perspective, how have tariffs, especially on steel, aluminum, and other key materials, how have they compounded or clashed with the bill's goals?
I think that there's been a few things going on here, and recently had the opportunity to do some education sessions with some of our legal friends. That was very helpful as well, but just about the tariffs. Because the tariffs are paid by the importer at the point of entry. So that's going to be the contractors bringing their goods in here. And as far as that's concerned, like, a lot of materials are coming from other countries. So, for example, lumber. 84% of softwood lumber comes from Canada. You know, aluminum that we use for windows, doors, frames, ladders, vehicles, that also comes from abroad. Steel is another one where you got like your sheet pilings, rail parts, any nails, bolts, elevator equipment parts, that sort of thing is all being affected by these tariffs now. So this has the potential to cause increased costs to the contractors as well as time delays on the jobs because getting the materials in, because this may cause some shortages as people, perhaps they're going to sort of like hoard what they can get when they can get it, you know? And it's like, if I'm going to go ahead and get a huge shipment, just let me get all of it. And so that can cause circumstances for others and the potential for a shortage as well as increase the cost. And then if you're spent waiting to get your materials in, then you're going to have time overruns on your jobs. So I don't know that that is potentially helpful for the bill as the bill is trying to increase economic activity and stuff. The one good thing is it is promoting like buy in the USA. The other thing, though, is like the availability to buy in the USA.
Yeah, I've heard in some cases it's still cheaper to buy overseas than it is in the USA. The goal would be everything's American made and buy in the USA, and that's to spark our economy. We'll just have to see how that plays out. And honestly, you know how it is. Every time you watch the news, a different deal is being made, a different tariff is being put in place or lifted. Yes. What construction materials are most affected by the tariffs, and how's the industry adapting to that?
Yeah, most of the effect has been, like I mentioned, aluminum, steel, lumber, those sort of things. And I think that because of this, it's causing people to kind of diversify where they get their materials from, reach out to other vendors that potentially they have not used before, and try to adapt, like you said, to buy American, to buy within our United States. It might take you a little bit of time to find somebody that you're comfortable with on that, but it could be a good thing. The only problem being like the supply and demand, because if everybody else is doing it too, we end up with some shortages. So,
yeah. So let's talk another key commodity, and that's labor. So how have workforce development and apprenticeships funding in the bill affected the staffing challenges that we've already seen in the construction industry?
So I think there has been a general trend toward in the high schools and colleges to promoting the trades and showing students that there is more than one avenue to success. There are initiatives in the bill to encourage educational institutions to lower costs. They're providing targeted financial aid for students that are enrolled in workforce training programs. And it includes measures and supports to expand their apprenticeship programs and opportunities. Additionally, there are provisions that are encouraging collaboration between educational institutions and businesses. And while this isn't a quick fix, we are hoping that this is going to fortify the shift that we've already seen in the past few years. And I know locally, we have a lot of industries and businesses that reach out not only to the EDA, but to the local community college to help develop trades programs and internships to make sure that the workforce is available.
Have you noticed any specific trades that are being hit the hardest by labor shortages?
Well, based on my conversations in the industry, I think electrical, plumbing, HVAC are in high demand. We're also seeing or hearing about a lot of shortages for project managers and safety supervisors as the people that have been in those roles are aging out because there was a lag in the people coming into the industry. You also have a gap between, you know, your newest staff and your supervisors.
We see a lot in the state of West Virginia promoting trade schools and the skilled trades, and I'm a big proponent of it. College fits some people, skilled trades fit other people. They're both excellent avenues, and I wouldn't steer anybody in a specific direction. It's just whatever fits them. Myself, I have a nephew, went through the electrical program at our technical center and where I live, and he came right out of high school with a good job, and it's just got voted into his electrical union hall. So people can make a great living doing that, and I think the more that we promote it as a state or a nation and get more young kids involved in it early and show people the opportunities that are out there, you know, that it's not just has to be one avenue to go down. There's multiple, and that's definitely a great avenue to go down.
I agree with that. And Corbin and I both are members of the National Association of Women in Construction, and that is one of the focuses that we have. And I'm certain like other construction-related business organizations do the same, but just letting the younger generation know that they have options. You know, and that this is a very viable career. And often you go into this and you can get a great job and have a lucrative career and very little debt to do so, which is amazing. But to start younger and younger is good because most of the time, statistically, if you look at it, by the time kids are in middle school, they've already decided what they want to be when they grow up. Also, most of the females have already decided that like a career in a STEM work industry is for boys only. So I think that it is important as like a state, a nation, these social business organizations to reach out to children at younger ages and show them what's available to them and the potential that they really have.
And that's another podcast that we did that you were on, Carla, with NAWIC, and I encourage anybody to go back and listen to that because we have seen a steady rise of ladies in the construction industry now. So it's prevalent and the opportunities are out there. I wish I knew what I wanted to do when I was in middle school or high school, even right now. I'm just doing this until my country music career takes off. I'm figured it out yet, but getting there. So how are tariffs and bill compliance issues impacting subcontractors differently than they are general contractors?
So I think that the impact is going to be different due to their, like, they have different distinct roles within their projects. So, I mean, first of all, with material costs, you look at the tariffs increasing these costs. The GCs are responsible for the overall procurement, you know, so they're faced with the increase of costs from this for the imported materials. The subcontractors on the specific trades, they have rising costs, but they tend to have less control over the purchasing. Another thing, as far as like project adjustments, the GC can alter like their scopes and timelines based on the tariffs, but then ultimately that can delay the subcontractor's task and put them behind this job, the next job. You know, I think that fixed price contracts, a lot of the subcontractors work under a fixed price agreement, so they have to absorb these increased material costs, and that's really going to affect their profit margins on their projects. And then just making sure that the GCs can competitively bid. While the costs rise and it costs them more to do these jobs, they may struggle a bit to be as competitive, and if that happens, then the subs underneath kind of have to navigate the uncertainty of the profitability and the changing cost. And ultimately for everybody though, it's a cash flow issue, because the delays caused by these tariffs can lead to cash flow challenges for both of them, and the payments tied to project milestones as well as the increase, things of that nature. So they both have their challenges, but they are distinctly different.
So are we starting to see any contract escalation clauses regarding tariffs yet? Or are we still too early in that? Or is that something that's, that we've seen yet?
So like I mentioned previously, we had the opportunity for some learning with some construction legal experts, because I am not a lawyer and I do not ever say anything about that, but they have mentioned that there are a lot of changes to the contract language to help the contractors mitigate the risk of the unknown. So the thing being that most of the time, the templates in the specific documents that are widely used in construction don't mention this specifically. So the contractors are most likely going to be adding escalation clauses to address these potential increases. They're probably going to be updating their force majeure language to include delays caused by tariffs. I think it's very important that the contractors have like a good relationship with their attorneys, and they reach out to them to make sure that they can assist them and make sure that their wording mitigates the risk of loss in these circumstances. They said that they have some boilerplate language that they kind of use in there as far as making sure that these options are available to both the contractor and the customer as far as splitting the effect of the increased cost on the jobs. But I would definitely recommend that contractors do reach out to their attorney and have them take a look at this and see where things need to be changed going forward, so that way they're not out there risking themselves too much.
So so have bonding and surety requirements changed due to these federal projects and the tariff risks?
Generally speaking, federal projects have stricter bonding criteria. A lot of times this is related to the financial stakes of the projects. Risk can impact these costs of materials and labor, which leads to the additional risk. We're seeing higher bonds or specialized bonds to address this risk. Again, this is an area where I would really encourage you to discuss the potential changes with your surety, with your attorney, CPA. I'd seek out advisors with construction experience. What you don't want to do is to be in a time crunch and be unaware that something has changed for you in terms of bonding or for banking for your loan covenants. So, you know, as the risk of the industry gets higher, you want to be very mindful of your financial reporting and how your ratios are going to impact you for both bonding and, you know, lending capabilities.
What are some of the best practices for staying compliant with the bill's funding and wage requirements?
This is something that we've talked about for a long time, from accountant to contractor, is invest in training of your accounting staff, your HR staff. You know, don't spare the expense of using certified payroll software or knowledgeable advisors, because what you gain in the setup or the advice or the purchase of the software a lot of times is outweighed by the benefit of not having mistakes, of the timeliness of your reporting. And non-compliance is not just risky in terms of your reputation, but it's also risky in terms of future contracting opportunities. So this is something, you know, obviously you have to stay within your budget, but it's not a sunk cost, so to speak. It's something that's going to benefit you over and over again during the course of administering your contracts.
Okay. So what role does technology play in managing both the bill compliance and tariff-related procurement?
That technology is going to play a big role in this. Contractors are going to need up-to-date software packages that has the best as far as contract cost tracking, budgeting, and your purchase order softwares, your modules in there for that, as well as like your change order management. I think the thing that you want to think about is staying on top of these items in real time to help make good decisions and see how your costs and deliveries are tracking. Keep track of them on a daily basis. If things are changing, if costs are escalating, things of that nature. And then if a change order is necessary, you need to do it as soon as possible and not wait until, you know, months later. To have the information available to you all the time is going to be your best interest. Forecasting costs on your projects, you can use historical data and current data, so you can kind of stay on top of trends, and that kind of prevents the overspending and is going to assist you with cash flow. I also think that payroll reporting is going to be very important. If you consider now with the bill and the no tax on overtime, we're not really sure how that's going to be reported yet, but making sure you have a good software that's going to stay updated and you're going to be reporting the items that you need to timely, it's a big deal, because it not only helps as far as your timeliness, keeping your employees, your overall project costs. And something else to think of, which I've heard a little bit about recently in some other conferences, is knowing technology that's available for certain options. As far as like robotics, they're a viable option. They can even increase your safety. So there are clients out there that now use like drones for inspections. I've seen them using robots for measurements and different things, because those items particularly can go into places where people may not be able to, or people can't go into them safely. And they're pretty accurate, as well as it does save some money and time, as your robot doesn't get paid overtime, you know, things like that. So just to keep in the back of their mind that technology can be your friend and is going to be very helpful throughout this whole process.
Well, and I think with that being said, I'm going to emphasize the training issue. You know, you can have the best system in the world, but if you don't have the processes and the staff in place to input the information and to maintain the information, you know, you may still have people pulling things out and managing it through Excel. And so it's very hard to capture the full picture if you don't have the necessary resources in your office.
Amen. Yeah.
Technology is exciting but scary when you think about what they're able to do with robots. We've had people do inventory with drones. You think about AI in the construction industry also. That's another podcast episode that we had on here, talking about how AI can be implemented for construction firms to improve efficiency. And we see it all the time. So staying on top of technology is huge, huge in terms of being ahead of the game and being ahead of your competition.
Yep. Yes, it is.
Yes. So how should contractors prepare financially for the next 12 to 24 months under the current policy climate?
I'd say there are a few things to look at as far as that's concerned. Looking at your budget, reassess your budget, see if you do have potential material costs due to these tariffs or supply chain issues. Factor in contingencies for those things in your budget now. We'd rather be conservative, you know, as far as those sort of things go. And then cash flow management, I think, is going to be really important, because with these things, if you are not getting your materials timely, you cannot work timely, you cannot bill timely. So make sure that you are managing your cash flow, you're strengthening it as best you can, optimizing your billing processes and things of that nature, the liquidity, the options that you have. Also, as I mentioned earlier, potentially diversifying your supply chains. We talked about buying in the USA as opposed to abroad. So with that, that can potentially help mitigate some of the impact on you. And then be cautious of the contracts and negotiations. Make sure that you have these clauses in your contracts in case this does happen, because it's kind of unknown. We're not sure what's going to happen just yet. And like we just mentioned, invest in technology and the training of your staff. This is going to help you manage your projects more efficiently and track your things in real time. So that's going to be better for your financial health as well, and making good decisions. Just make sure you're building strong relationships. Have open communication with, like, your customers, your suppliers, your subs, also your attorneys, your CPAs. Make sure that you are staying informed of all the changes, the market trends, and things that could impact this industry, and be proactive as possible. So I think that's going to kind of help them navigate the uncertain waters, if you will. What do you think, Corbin?
I would echo your sentiments in terms of communication is key. You're going to see a lot of clarification and guidance being issued, you know, in the coming months as it relates to reporting. I'd be careful where you get your information. You know, TikTok is great, but you don't want that to be your advisor. You know, be a part of your trade organizations, whether it's NAWIC, CFMA, AGC, people that are going to give you credible information and give you guidance. Make sure that your advisors are reputable. Make sure they have the construction experience so they can help you navigate these things. And in terms of labor, you know, so many times we talk about tax strategies and our bonding strategies, but in a world and in a profession where, you know, there is a labor shortage, I would say even look at the benefits of it for your employees. I mean, are you able to provide a 401k? You know, is that something that you can look at? Are you providing insurance for your employees? Are there incentives available? So I think sometimes taking a step back and looking at, you know, your benefit packages and your flexible work arrangements where available, when you can do those things and keep good people, I think that's as important as any other planning that you can do. Again, in relation to the tariffs, just make sure you're addressing the provisions in your contracts and budgeting. I know that we've touched on that several times. You know, with that being an unknown, you just cannot think, oh, I'll just deal with this after the fact. That's something that you should be proactive. And as with any tax planning, I just say make sure that you're in contact on a regular basis with your advisors and look at, you know, September, October, make sure that you're getting your books tied down, understand what your job progress is, and make sure that you know where you really are for the upcoming year so that you can do good planning.
Very good. I believe that gets us about to the end of the episode. Are there any final words or parting shots y'all'd like to let the listeners know about?
Just be proactive. Like Corbin said, the communication, don't hesitate to reach out to your CPAs, your attorneys. And I joke a little bit about when these big bills come and things really shift in the tax world, I feel like I've been training for this my whole life. I'm ready.
And coach.
Yeah. So use those assets that you have with your CPAs and your advisors. Don't hesitate, because that's what they're there for. You know, that's what they do, and that's how they want to help you.
Yes. Well, I greatly appreciate both of you all taking the time, doing the research, and just being, like I said, the undisputed construction tax tag team champions of the world and helping out with everything that we do at Brown Edwards and being on the podcast today. Hope to have you all again another time, maybe after the one biggest, more beautiful bill gets passed to supersede this one. We'll see.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So there you have it, folks. This wraps up another episode of Constructive Conversations. Be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel and listen to the podcast wherever you listen to your podcast and get them from. This has been Eddie Thompson, Carla Brown, and Corbin Rice. Keep on building.